Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And of course, we're running a new format these days. In this week's show, you're going to hear Adam Boileau and I discuss the week's news. Then we're moving right on into this week's sponsor interview with Jen Andre of Rapid7. Jen is the founder of Command, that's with a K, which was a security automation and orchestration company, but is now a part of Rapid7, as from about midway through last year. I spoke to Jen a bit about how she came to start Command and where the security automation and orchestration discipline is at right now. That's a fun chat, and it's coming up later. But first up, of course, it is time for an extended check of the week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, of course, we have reported a few times on this guy, Nia Hong Pho, who used to work for Tailored Access Operations at the NSA. This was someone who was taking their homework back to their house, which isn't really advisable when you work in that sort of job. He got caught, of course. He's gone to court, and it looks like he's going to prison for something like 5.5 years.
Yeah, we reported, I think, back in December that he pled guilty to it. So there wasn't a really, you know, complicated trial process. But yeah, the sentencing they were going for, the government was going for 96 months prison for him. He's going to face 66. The reporting isn't super clear yet whether this is the guy that's responsible for the Shadow Brokers data set. I mean, the early reporting did say that. And then, you know, that link has never really been acknowledged anywhere. Certainly this is some of the reporting we saw last year suggested that this was one of the guys that was running Kaspersky on his home system, and we think
The reporting has in fact linked this guy's computer to Kaspersky's admission that it did hoover up some files, but only because, you know, they viewed them as a totally threatening threat actor and wanted to create signatures for all of their people, you know, like for all of their users, right? So, you know, this guy has very much been, through reporting, been linked to the Kaspersky scandal.
Yeah, and I think it's not an unreasonable supposition to say that this could well be the data that ended up the Shadow Brokers, but yeah, we don't actually know that. You know, the sentence is certainly, you know, 5 years in jail is, I guess, pretty stern for, you know, taking some things home. You know, he didn't, I guess, intentionally leak them. So a little bit different than, say, the case of Reality Winner, which we have talked about in the past, once they've, you know, as they've been rounding up NSA leakers in the post-Snowden, post-Shadow Brokers world.
6 years seems to be about standard, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it does. But, I mean, then again, like, if you look at the bigger picture story, I mean, the amount of damage from, you know, WannaCry and all of the other, you know, Eternal Blue things.
I mean, Not Petya,
of course, yeah. You know, it is a pretty big deal, and maybe, you know, his part in that is worth 5 years in jail. I don't know.
Well, I mean, one interesting thing here is Politico got a hold of a letter to the court written by Mike Rogers, who was the director of the NSA at the time. And, you know, he says things like, Mr. Pho retained classified information outside of properly secured spaces, and by doing so, and here's the interesting part, caused very significant and long-lasting harm to the NSA and consequentially to the national security of the United States. Now, if that information went no further than his home computer, I think that that paragraph there is very difficult to justify. So I would suggest that at the very least, he took information home that wound up being hoovered up by Kaspersky. Whether or not that information also wound up in the hands of the group we know as the Shadow Brokers, well, we don't know. But you're right. I mean, it does seem like a reasonable thing that you could say that this could be the guy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the data does suggest that. And yeah, you're right. The wording from Admiral Rogers is pretty, you know, what is it? We were forced, the NSA was left with no choice but to abandon certain important initiatives at great economic and operational cost, which, as you say, if it was just on his home machine, you know, maybe that wouldn't be the case.
But as I say, that substantiates the link to the Kaspersky event that Kaspersky itself has acknowledged, but it doesn't necessarily link it to Shadow Brokers, because you would still have to abandon ops if you were using tooling that had wound up on Kaspersky's cloud AV scanner, right? So it's kind of hard to know.
True, we don't know.
You know, and I'd love to know if Hal Martin was a Kaspersky user. I mean, that's, in fact, you and I may have actually had that conversation with Rob Joyce in the United States, where I'd said, you know, if I could ask the Oracle three questions, you know, that would be one of them.
Yeah, he was amused. I'm not sure the press minders, PR minders, were amused with that question that you asked.
Hi, by the way, NSA Hi, Press
everybody.
Office, if you're listening. We got a great little disaster story here, which really, I mean, I love this one because you just sort of think, what would you do in this situation? This company Zoho, which has apparently 30 million users, I'd never heard of them personally. Their domain registrar just like nuked their domain and, you know, none of their users could get service and that was that. I mean, and yeah, I mean, there were a lot of people jumping up and down on Twitter over this one, but like, did the registrar have any decent reason for doing this?
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, the story seems to go that they are like a cloud services provider, like think kind of like Google Apps sort of thing, where there's mail and CRM and word processing and spreadsheets and that kind of thing as a service web application. I think the story is that some of the users who used mail on this platform, were spamming or whatever, got reported for phishing or something, and that ended up at the registrar. And apparently, there have been 3 complaints over the last, you know, a few months or whatever, all of which have been actioned by the company Zoho.
Oh, bar one, they were investigating one. But yeah, 3 complaints in 2 months. If they got 30 million users, I think they're kind of punching above their weight.
Yeah, that seems pretty good. But yeah, the registrar, I think, like, it sounds like some automated process just kind of got invoked when, you know, without a human actually thinking about what was going on. And yeah, they got their domain blackholed, ruined everything. And then even once they did sort it out, presumably by yelling at people on Twitter, of course, the DNS caches around the world took a while. And yeah, it was sort of a funny scenario.
I was seeing them like issuing advice saying, please go to 1.1.1.1, you know, because Cloudflare has it all back up and cooking. But oh man, what a disaster. But I saw a couple of people tweeting around, you know, this is a tabletop scenario. Like, what would you do if your organization's primary domain just gets nuked? Like, it's a hell of a situation.
Yeah, there's that, what's the Twitter account that comes up with, you know, like disaster scenarios for this kind of thing? Like, it's exactly one of those, you know, your domain just gets turned off by your registrar. So yeah, everyone who does tabletop exercising who listens, maybe give that one a go. It's a good bit of fun to think about how many things are going to get wrecked without DNS.
Turning attention now to Australia's Assistance and Access Bill. This is, you know, what some people are calling the anti-encryption legislation. We are seeing some rather pointed and valid criticism being directed at this government bill by, like, the Communications Alliance, representing telecommunications companies, who are saying, look, you know, under this legislation, we can see a reading whereby authorities in Australia could force the major telcos to preload every single handset sold in Australia with some sort of remote access software. I think that would be, just from what I've seen of the bill, I think that would be a rather unusual reading of what it says can and can't happen. But if, you know, lobby groups like this are getting this bent out of shape about it, I certainly would like to know that is something that can't happen as well. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, we're seeing some more detailed criticism about this bill hitting the newspapers, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, anything that provokes discussion around these things is good. I mean, even if some of the positions being held are, you know, kind of purposefully extreme, like it may not exactly say that, but it's kind of how they're choosing to interpret it for the benefit of the discussion. Like, that is still a useful thing to happen. And obviously these kinds of laws do need to be, you know, got right and have the right balance of things. And yeah, you know, even though the discussion, and certainly like the Sydney Morning Herald article that's in the news list that people want to read is a little bit hysterical in places, I guess, it's still good for the conversation as a whole, and it's a super important conversation. So
yeah, and I think we need carve-outs for this sort of stuff. We need to be, you know, the problem is the government's trying to get this one like pushed through immediately, right? And until it can answer questions like this, I mean, it certainly won't have my support, let's put it that way. You know, it'd be nice to see maybe some carve-outs that can protect our export industries as well, because there are some countries that like to buy Australian equipment because, you know, following the Snowden disclosures, they don't trust America anymore, right? So could we get ourselves into a position where those countries don't trust Australia anymore? There's a lot more that we need to think about. This bill needs more review, and it is a shame that the government's trying to push it through so quickly.
Yeah, and we certainly had a pretty good rant last week about how much we don't trust telcos to do the right thing in general.
Yeah.
And, you know, handing over, you know, the keys to, you know, backdoors on every phone. I mean, I know to a certain extent the carriers can already kind of push things down to the phones and that kind of thing, but you know, that having an actual access regime that has the stuff pre-installed, you know, is not a thing that I would like to see a telco, you know, in control of as a normal kind of day-to-day thing. So, yeah.
Nor would anyone sensible, I would think. Moving on to CyberScoop now. And look, a lot of outlets are reporting this one. It looks like there was some sort of glitch in Twitter's API that was leaking direct messages that Twitter users may have sent to online brands using a certain type of Twitter management software, and those DMs wound up being read by Twitter developers. It looks like a pretty sort of obscure edge case here, not some sort of, you know, Cambridge Analytica style API disaster. But what can you tell me about it, Adam?
So the details of the bug are still a little bit vague. I mean, the things that I read suggested that there was some mechanism whereby third-party developers who had access to a particular Twitter API for managing DMs could in some cases end up, I think, seeing the images from direct messages was what I read somewhere. Someone suggested maybe it's like a hash collision or there's some kind of, you know, there was something that let you see other people's images. But yeah, so it's not super clear. I mean, Twitter at least have been telling specific users that some of their messages may have been impacted by. I saw Katie Mazuris, for example, retweeting the notification that she'd got about some of her DMs. And she was, of course, saying, well, which DMs, to whom, when, you know, give us some actual actionable data. Which I think is a pretty fair criticism, but yeah, it doesn't...
Yeah, but can you imagine being the person responsible for piecing all that together? Oh, that's a project.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's super complicated, but I mean, as an end user, if you want to trust the platform, then, you know, that's not an unreasonable question to expect an answer to. The fact that it's hard is not the user's concern. But yeah, certainly it could be a lot worse. I mean, it's not like, say, that Reddit bug from, you know, what was it, a few months ago where they lost the database that had all of the messages from, you know, 5-6 years ago or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, still, you know, concerning. But I guess a reminder that, you know, Twitter is not a particularly robust messaging service for private messaging, and you know, you should keep that in mind when you're using it for DMs.
Equifax has been fined. It's a very big deal. The UK's data protection agency has fined Equifax for its actions related to the company's massive data breach, and oh my god, it's a whopping amount of £500,000. However will they cope?
I know, right? And it's funny because apparently that is the maximum that they could apply.
Yeah.
$660,000 worth, £500,000, which, you know, given they had, what, 15 million UK citizens were affected in the Equifax breach, you know, isn't really that much money. And I guess, you know, Equifax, you know, is going to quite happily pay that because, you know, had they done this post-GDPR, then they'd be looking at, what was it, 4% of global revenues?
Yep, it's either 20 million euros or 4% of an organization's annual global revenue, whichever is greater. So, you know, bullet dodged, man. £500,000, bargain.
Yeah, exactly. Bargain basement. But no, it's, I mean, it's good to see, you know, a stick being waved at Equifax, but it's just sad that the stick is very small and going to break, so, you know.
Now, next up, I want to mention this Yubico release. Yubico has released the YubiKey 5, but I can't mention that without also mentioning that, you know, Risky Business participated in the launch of that product. We published a Soapbox podcast the other day, you know, where I spoke to the SVP of product at Yubico all about it, but I'm happy to mention it in the news as well because, you know, this is a full FIDO2 enabled token that even does FIDO2 over NFC. It's supported by Windows. It's, you know, it's the new cool, and I suspect we're going to see a lot of these YubiKeys on a lot of keyrings in the near future.
Yeah, I mean, YubiKey has, you know, really been an important part of the, you know, kind of providing alternative second factor that isn't clunky and horrible to use. Integration with the browser has been super handy. And I think, you know, by virtue of having been the kind of the leader in this market, that their next move is a thing people are going to pay a lot of attention to. Certainly the integration with Windows is going to be a thing that gets a lot of attention, I think. And, you know, I'm certainly looking forward to getting my hands on an actual, you know, instance to play with.
Well, I mean, it's totally passwordless, right? So it's not something where it unlocks some local password vault or, you know, it's actually proper passwordless enabled via FIDO2. And I've seen it in action and it's kind of, you know, it's one of those moments where it's just like, okay, this, people are going to want this. This is going to change the way that a lot of people log into their computers at work, whether that's tapping with RFID, you know, tap and pin or plug in and pin, whatever it is, this is... It seems to me to be a much better way to handle, to solve the log, you know, user login issue as opposed to passwords.
Yeah, I mean, having a place to start that trust process that isn't a password, because obviously there's going to be a lot of stuff that still requires passwords in the future, but once you've got a trusted auth mechanism, then you can bootstrap everything else. And that's really been the problem, is that passwords have been the initial kind of trust anchor for everything, or even worse, you know, like knowledge-based password reset questions. So anything that kind of gets away from that absolutely is a good thing. We've talked a lot of times over the years about, you know, the fact that we do need to find a way past passwords. This is certainly a pretty good step in that direction. And well, hopefully, you know, people will take it up and we'll see a bunch of research and, you know, we might see some bugs. That'll be fine as well. This seems like a good thing.
Yep. Now we're going to look at some goings on in the UK now. Privacy International says that not only was some of its information collected as part of British intelligence bulk collection programs, but they're also saying that MI5 has looked at information that was collected under this program. But they're a little bit kind of vague about the details there, aren't they, Adam?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, the story goes, Privacy International have an ongoing kind of legal challenge to the kind of mass interception that the British government does as part of its intelligence programs. And in the process of this, they've got to the point where GCHQ and MI5 and MI6 have all admitted to kind of collecting data about, you know, amongst other people, obviously, Privacy International, because they're located in London and there's data going to and from them. Privacy International are asserting that they did, that the agencies, and particularly MI5, did specifically look at their data, and I mean, whether they acted upon it is kind of implied, I guess. But there's no real suggestion as to, you know, kind of whether or not that was part of an actual investigation that they were doing, whether it was something else, whether it was recreational, you know.
Or whether it was an email thread between them and Ed Snowden.
Yeah, exactly. So we don't really know what the context is. And Privacy International obviously put out a press release, which kind of makes it sound like, you know, they've been proven right in their assertions that this...
And the government's spying on us, and it's an imminent threat to democracy. And, you know, I mean, look, this is stuff that, you know, the concerns here are totally valid, but it just sort of feels like they are hamming it up a little bit. And it's a shame, because this comes hot on the heels of, GCHQ's surveillance being found by the European Court of Human Rights to be illegal, right? So we didn't talk about that one last week, but... You know, there's a real conversation to be had here, and Privacy International seem to be just sort of hamming it up in a weird way, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a conversation that really does need actual good data and not just kind of, you know, glossing over it and hyperbole and hamming, because it really does no favours to those of us that, there are absolutely very real concerns here, but they're not helped by hyperbole.
Well, the ECHR stuff was interesting as well, because a lot of what they said about GCHQ programs was there was insufficient oversight and inadequate safeguards over some of this bulk interception stuff. So that's interesting to see if, you know, GCHQ might be able to, you know, beef up oversight to bring it more into compliance. And then what do? Do you go back to the court and say, these are our new oversight procedures? It's not, I don't know. It's a bit of a mess, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is, right? And it's very hard to demonstrate that you're doing it right without also, you know, kind of exposing your operational capability and all the kind of, you know, other concerns we've seen used to push back against really being open. But, I mean, you know, this absolutely does have to have effective oversight.
Yeah.
And, you know, by whatever mechanism you get to that, and certainly, you know, you talk to people who work in the spook world, right? Clearly it is possible to have, you know, oversight, because they all complain about how much of a pain it is.
They do.
But, you know, maybe that's still not enough. I don't know. Maybe the British are a little more slack about it. I don't know. But, it's hard to tell from out here in the unclassed world, you know, what's actually going on and to what extent it is effective.
We've got an interesting one here. NSS Labs has filed an antitrust lawsuit against a whole bunch of security vendors. And these are companies like CrowdStrike and ESET and Symantec. And they're also suing the Anti-Malware Testing Standards Organization, which is an organization that, you know, a lot of those sort of companies are members of. This organization is kind of like an attempt for the industry to try to create an accepted testing framework. So what some of these vendors are doing is they've got language in their end-user license agreements that prohibit unauthorized testing, and they're trying to, you know, move everyone into this sort of standardized testing. NSS has said this is a terrible antitrust problem, and they've launched a suit. I really am not sure what to make of this one. What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny for a number of reasons. One of them is that NSS Labs themselves are a member of the Anti-Malware Testing Standards Organization, so they're suing an organization, professional industry organization that they are themselves a member of. But yeah, it's I don't know. Like, if you talk to any of the security vendors whose products get tested by NSS Labs, no one has anything nice to say. You know, I've been to a few conferences where, you know, drinking a few beers afterwards with, you know, AV people, and you just get a torrent of stories about how terrible the process of the testing was and how unrepresentative it was and all this kind of thing. So there are, by smoke, where the smoke, the fire kind of thing, there are some complaints about the processes that they use for testing and how realistic it is and the extent to which it can kind of be gamed by vendors that are willing to play, you know, by the rules of the testing to a certain extent. But on the other hand, right, we've also seen plenty of security vendors, you know, make unrealistic claims about their products or, you know, make assertions that are only true in very specific configurations that are not representative. So
I think you and I are kind of coming at this from a similar angle, which is we would probably both agree that vendors should not be able to prohibit third-party independent testing of their products. I think we would agree on that, correct?
Yeah, clearly, right. As a company that does independent testing for a living, yes, I agree.
But we've also heard the same things about NSS, which is why we're like, oh.
Yeah, pretty much, right? You know, I don't know that it's the best organization to be doing that kind of thing. But yeah, on the other hand, prohibiting testing, you know, Oracle's approach to, you know, not allowing anyone to look at anything ever is also completely counterproductive. So maybe they can all just sue each other into the ground and the rest of us can just kind of carry on.
We've got an interesting one here from an Australian think tank, ASPI, which is the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. They have an online publication called The Strategist, and one of their cyber people, Fergus Hansen, has written a really interesting little piece of where we're at when it comes to so-called Chinese cyber espionage.
Yeah, it's you can have a good write-up of sort of some of the history, the kind of ramp-up towards the agreement between the Obama administration and the Chinese to kind of step back on commercially originated hacking. It has some interesting bits about the extent to which some of the Chinese hacking activity for commercial benefit that we saw was, you know, by state actors in their spare time for their own personal profit, which was then kind of cracked down upon in as part of the anti-corruption move by the current Chinese administration. But yeah, it's kind of interesting, you know, kind of lays out the story arc of where we are and, you know, suggests that we are back in a place where, you know, the Chinese have tried to arrive at a level of commercial espionage that is beneficial for them, but still acceptable.
Just below the threshold for where, you know, the targets take action, I think is where they're trying to position themselves, right? That's what this piece is saying.
That is, yeah.
Which is, you know, which is very smart when you think about it.
Yeah, well, no one says they're not smart.
I just found it interesting here because they're basically saying that, you know, the signing of that agreement with the Obama administration sort of coincided with some internal changes and a crackdown on corruption. We don't know how much we can attribute the decrease in activity then to the agreement versus just internal restructuring, and that it has come back, but the behavior is definitely modified. So I just think it was a really interesting piece, and well done, Fergus Hansen. Anyone who's interested in that can check it out in this week's show notes. Now, we spoke about this guy getting arrested a while ago. This is the dude who is operating, like, they're calling it, I think quite accurately, Virus Total for, you know, for criminals. This guy was offering the service Scan for You, where you could throw your malware at it and it would, you know, scan it with a bunch of engines and tell you, okay, you know, you're good to go, start your campaign. Ruslan Bondas, he's 37 years old. He's been convicted and he was just sentenced to 14 years in prison. Bad luck for you.
Yes, bad luck indeed. They assert that he was responsible for attacks that involved losses of up to $20 billion, hence the rather, you know, rather long sentence. And, you know, the rhetoric was that, you know, they were kind of holding him responsible for activities that were enabled by his service rather than necessarily ones that he'd done himself. You know, I guess to kind of send a message to people who are participating in the, you know, larger crime ecosystem, but have kind of, you know, convinced themselves through kind of, you know, nerd rules weaseling that they're not actually doing the crime. They're just, you know, running virus scanners or whatever. So I think this is kind of designed to send a message that, you know, we don't care for your nerdy rules weaseling because that's not actually how it works out here in the real world. So
That's right. Bye-bye. See you in 14 years, apparently, is what's happened there. Now, someone who got off a little bit lighter is this Tencent, you know, security person who was at Hack in the Box in, was it Singapore? And he decided just to go nuts. Not only did he decide to go nuts hacking the hotel Wi-Fi where he was staying, but he wound up posting like all of the details of what he'd been up to all over his social media accounts. So he got caught and fined, and he didn't go to prison though, did he?
Yeah, apparently not, which, you know, given that it's Singapore, I'm kind of amazed at.
I'm amazed they didn't haul him out into the public square and whack him with a cane, you know?
I know, right? But he got $5,000, $5,000 Sing, I'm assuming, fine for it, which, yeah, I kind of expected a sterner punishment from the Singaporeans, but, you know, it didn't seem like he was particularly, you know, he wasn't necessarily malicious about it. Obviously, apparently he got default creds or whatever, owned the wireless controller or whatever component it was, and then blogged about it with a bunch of, and cracked a bunch of creds that he got through that process, posted those. So yeah, I mean, it was clearly not particularly clever. You know, maybe he should have saved it for like that night or, you know, the next day when presumably he was going to go play the CTF at Hack in the Box. But no, had to start early.
I just love how precise Singaporean law is on this matter, because he pleaded guilty to one count of intentionally disclosing a password providing unauthorized access to data belonging to Fragrance Hotel. That is a very specific charge, Singapore. Well done. You've just imagined every scenario, haven't you?
Yeah. Dear. Well, I mean, at least it all ended well, I guess. $5,000 is not too much to be taught a lesson. They could have gone a lot worse.
Now, look, we don't normally cover capital raising among startups or whatever, but this company, Snick, has just raised $22 million, and some of that money is actually coming from Google, which I think makes it, from Google Ventures, which I think makes this interesting. I also think it's interesting that it's a supply chain tool that actually looks to be pretty useful. What do you think of this, Adam?
Yeah, so I mean, their core product is essentially like a database of open source components and security vulnerabilities in those components, and then providing tooling so that you can figure out what open source supply chain bits you're using and, you know, what the kind of patch state is, which, you know, doesn't seem like it's a super complicated problem to solve. But on the other hand, you talk to anybody who's got containerized anything and ask them what's in their supply chain, I have no idea. So it does solve a very real problem. And Google has absolutely done loads of work in that area. So
it's not like building a mission to Mars, right? But someone's got to do it. And that's going to take money and a lot of work.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the hard bit of this, right, is maintaining the database of good quality vulnerable information and also being able to figure out what's in use and what, you know, be able to analyze it. You know, a virtual machine image or, you know, a container image and figure out what's in there. You know, so those are, you know, not difficult problems, but they are fiddly.
Ah, the boys over at Motherboard, Lorenzo and Joe, they've got a story here really writing up the demo experience for potential customers of NSO Group who want to buy their awesome iPhone malware. And, you know, it sounds like they got a pretty sweet demo, actually.
Yeah, no, it's a great story. They talk about the experience of some guy that went in to have the demo, and he brought a new iPhone with him, and the demo was he put it on the table, and then, you know, 2 or 3 minutes later, the contents of the phone are appearing on the flat screen TV on the wall of the meeting room because they've owned his phone, you know, via remote zero interaction, you know, iOS bugs, and then have loaded their implant and are pulling down, you know, the mail and the messages and all the other bits and pieces, activating the camera, activating the mic. Like, the sales guys for NSO must have such a sweet life. Like, it's just super straightforward. Like, you do that, anyone's going to buy your product. So that's,
and they didn't
fun.
Even need your boy Surge in there distracting him. One shot, one kill. Gotta love it.
Yeah, exactly right. But yeah, the other couple of bits of the article that are interesting is there's some interesting numbers about kind of the amount of people that work at NSO and the amount of money involved, which kind of lets you sort of put some vague numbers around the pricing of the tooling, which, you know, is kind of interesting to get some, you know, get some feel for it, and, you know, looks pretty expensive.
It does, and I was really surprised when I was reading this that it looks like they don't actually have that many customers.
Yeah, the Motherboard article reports that they have something like 350 to 500 devices licensed to be owned around the world, so that they are, you know, selling the capability per device, and that they don't necessarily have a whole bunch of customers, like in the order of 15 to 30 devices per customer, which, you know, interesting to compare with the reports that we were talking about last week from Citizen Labs, you know, looking at the geographic distribution of those. But yeah, there's a bunch of information that NSO have kind of provided about how they do oversight of that. And if they're doing it on the level of, you know, individual devices that they've licensed to get owned, then that's certainly, you know, a little bit more attempted oversight than, say, we saw from Hacking Team.
Sure, but we have seen their stuff turn up on a couple of people's phones that it absolutely shouldn't have, so it can't be that great.
No, so I mean, this is the challenge, of course, is that NSO is saying one thing, and then some of the stories, you know, really are, you know, don't really line up with that, and we don't really know. The only thing I guess that I'm relieved about is that if they are licensing it per device, and it is in the order of, you know, $100,000, a couple hundred thousand US dollars or whatever per device, then that at least does mean, that, you know, regardless of you know, your you know, of whether your law and local law enforcement would like to have overreach, they probably can't afford to do it.
Yeah, you know, well, and that's why we've got the Assistance and Access Bill before the Australian Parliament right now, right?
So well,
that's,
yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, if it was just a case of, like, you know, the local police here investigating a car theft ring could, you know, drop $200K on a sweet iPhone Trojan, you know, great, but they can't, and I don't want them to because I'm a taxpayer.
Yeah, well, exactly right. It does highlight that kind of tension between the ridiculous amount of money involved and how terrible the other options are. So.
Now, look, regular listeners would know that, you know, I sort of agree with Alex Stamos on this, and I believe that platform abuse is a security issue. This next story is about a Facebook content moderator who is actually suing the company, saying that she has PTSD after working as a content moderator. You know, and you can imagine, right, if by the time something bubbles up to human eyes in a Facebook content moderation queue, I am totally willing to believe that you could wind up a PTSD-riddled mess after doing that job for a while. What do you think of this?
Well, it must be a god-awful job. Like, I can't imagine, like, going to work all day and having to look at the worst of the internet.
Yeah. Executions and child exploitation material all day. That's got to be fun.
All day, every day. And this lady, Selena Scola, who's taken this particular suit against Facebook, you know, is alleging that they didn't provide enough training, that they didn't provide enough support for, you know, counseling or other things to try and, you know, kind of take care of the people whom they are asking to look at this stuff. Facebook, on the other hand, of course, has come up and said, you know, oh, well, we have, you know, counseling and we have, you know, rooms we can go and play foosball or whatever to get over the child abuse, which, you know, I guess I haven't worked there. I don't know how effective that is, but clearly, you know, having to do that all day, every day is going to take a toll on people, and it's incumbent upon Facebook to really do, you know, the best that they can to support those people. And, you know, hopefully they do something already, but, you know, I'm sure there's more that they could be doing.
I'm not sure how much child exploitation material they have to deal with. You know, a lot of it's like so-called, you know, hate speech, graphic violence, self-harm images in video, nudity, sexual content. That's what they say. But you are seeing the worst of human nature constantly. But I can tell you that I have had conversations with people who've worked, you know, child exploitation investigations on behalf of police services. And, you know, I've had conversations with them where they've broken down because it has them up that much, and they certainly weren't getting enough support from the service that they were working for. So, you know, it absolutely is something that we need to take seriously. We need to look after the people who we are exposing to the worst of humanity, don't we?
Yeah, we do. It is necessary for us to do that, because it's not reasonable to ask someone to do this. You know, even if you're paying them well, right, it's not reasonable to ask them to do it and then just go home like they've had a regular 9-to-5.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. Microsoft has now rolled out, you know, confidential computing. This is like SGX enclaved computing for Azure. I often wonder who's going to be making use of this, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things that seems like a great idea.
You know, I mean, although SGX is a great place to do your, like, sort of, you know, cache attacks and stuff, right?
So, well, yeah, of course.
I'm not sold yet. Let's put it that way.
No, I mean, I agree. I don't think I am either. And there's kind of two aspects to it. Like, one you touched on, which is the, you know, the what are you actually going to use this for? Who's actually going to use this? And then the other half is, yeah, as you say, SGX maybe isn't ready for really big, like, prime time use. You know, we are still seeing side channels. We are still seeing, you know, bugs in that implementation. And in the end, I mean, SGX isn't the holy grail of this kind of computing. Like, I mean, what you really want is you want to be able to run, you know, encrypted code on encrypted data such that it's never decrypted on the remote end. And this is not what SGX does, right? It's just kind of, you know, another ring in the CPU that kind of makes
hides
some
processes. What a great idea.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just, you know, we've seen how effective Intel's, you know, constraints around, you know, platform management mode and the other, you know, in the hypervisor and all the other kind of bits of stuff that haven't been super effective at segregation, and adding yet another sort of segregation to CPU, you know, doesn't fill me with confidence in general. And yeah, obviously I'm sure the, you know, Azure engineers have done as good a job as they can implementing it, but, you know, what real problem is this solving?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing there's got to be something driving demand for this, because it is a thing that is happening and it's not just happening with Microsoft. So I think there's probably something out there. I don't know. I'm probably going to get an email from a listener in like 2 days saying, well, the reason this is happening is X.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, now Cloudflare has been an early mover on encrypted SNIs, which is kind of interesting. The technical details here are actually pretty interesting. Encrypted SNIs are here.
Yeah, so the process here is that during a TLS negotiation, if you're connecting to an IP that has multiple DNS names behind it, because normally if you want to validate cert, you're validating that the DNS lookup matches the cert, and the server doesn't know what DNS you looked up to get there, so it can only give you one cert. And the SNI is so that you can say during the TLS negotiation, actually, I'd like to connect to this particular domain instead of that one, and the server can give you the right certificate. That's in the clear during the hello process of the TLS connection. Cloudflare have done here is implemented a mechanism where a client that wants to make a connection can go ask for a DNS record that has a public key in it, encrypt the SNI that they'd like to connect to with that public key, then connect to the server. An observer on the wire can't see what name you're asking for during the SNI process, so that people observing don't necessarily know that and can't make decisions about it.
Catalan Kimpanu, writing for ZDNet, has filed this story about some of the slop that Windows leaves behind on your disk, some of the text that it leaves behind on your disk. This is something that's been sort of discussed and known about for a couple of years, but he's got a good write-up here.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like forensic people have known about this for a while, but it's just kind of getting some prominence now.
It's getting some mainstream love.
Some mainstream love, yes. If you have a Windows machine that has the handwriting inputs, you've got a pen-based Surface tablet or something, if you've got the handwriting recognition turned on, then it builds a dictionary of words from your local machine to assist the text recognition in figuring out local stuff that you're writing about that won't necessarily be in the standard training set. And it uses the Windows search indexer to kind of fill that database. And the net result is that people are ending up with, passwords and emails and all sorts of other, maybe otherwise ephemeral data lying around in this waitlist.dat file that's used to power the handwriting recognition. So yeah, if you have that turned on, good thing for forensic people to steal, good thing for post-intrusion hackers to nick off with and find some passwords perhaps as well.
Patrick Wardle has come up with a fun little bit of research here affecting Mac OS. Although a frustrating thing is I've seen most of the media making way too much of a big deal about this. Basically, he's found a way to bypass privacy restrictions on Mac OS that would prevent someone who had fleeting access to your computer while it was logged in. These protections are designed to stop them from downloading that person's contacts or copying that person's contacts. And he's got a bypass for that, which, okay, that's cool. But, people are writing it up like it's this zero-day end of the world.
Yeah, I think he's been working a bunch on these kinds of bypasses using the assistive technology stuff, I think is what it is.
Patrick Wardle knows how to Mac. This is not about him at all, It's just the write-ups have been a little bit crazy.
Yeah, they have. I think it's, everyone gets a bit hysterical about, I can bypass the, camera approval dialogue or whatever it is. It's clearly not, super exciting as some of the headlines are trying to make it out. And yeah, obviously, given there was just a recent Mac OS X release update, it's kind of, everyone's talking, of course, about the new Mojave OS X release. And yeah, it makes for good headlines saying, hey, there's something wrong with it.
Yeah, indeed. Now the ZDI, the Zero Day Initiative, which is actually owned by Trend Micro these days, they just went full disk on Microsoft, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, they dropped this bug, which is I think it's a memory corruption, actually, in the MS Jet database engine. Those of you who are old enough to remember Microsoft Access, MS Jet's the database kind of that is behind Microsoft Access. I think in this case, if you can provide a malicious MDB file whatever MS Jet things are called these days, to the engine, then you can leverage that into code execution, which is pretty cool, I guess. They reported to Microsoft and announced past whatever, arbitrary full disclosure timeline restriction that they had, I think it was 120 days of ZDIs.
Yep, 4 months.
Yeah, and so they've dropped that one. So seems kind of a niche bug, but I'm sure some people will own some things with it.
And finally, Adam, we're going to end with two stories here, both pertaining to Cisco. They're having kind of a bad week.
Yes, there's been reports that a bunch of Cisco products are affected by, there's a Linux kernel, TCP fragment reassembly bug. There's a bunch of Cisco products that use Linux kernels on the inside, and obviously having your network devices, network security controls vulnerable to denial of service is not a thing that you really want. But yeah, they've been going around patching those. You'd think that fragmentation is a thing that we'd kind of got under control.
I know. I was literally just sitting here thinking the same thing, but like it's 2018 and, you know, if you want to confuse networking and security gear, all you need to do is fragment your packets in a strange way and, you know, things start falling over. Oh, God.
Yeah. But no, so it's... Yeah, it seems to affect a bunch of Cisco Nexus switch gear, Aeronet access points, some of the other Cisco centralized wireless controller bits and pieces. So, you know, this is kit that a lot of people have out there in prod. And, you know, if the if you don't want them to be turned off, then you should probably go and talk to Cisco Tech about getting some patches.
But it's the next one. It's the next one that we're going to end on because the world-leading provider of hard-coded credentials has done it again.
Yes, indeed. If you have Cisco's Video Surveillance Manager product, version 7, I think, is the one affected. Yeah, it turns out there was a hard-coded you-can't-change-it root password, which they are recommending that you patch to have changed. The Cisco advisory doesn't say what the password is, but if you type it into Google, you too can find out what the password is. And I'll give you a little bit of a spoiler. It is secure for you.
Nice.
So, you know, a little bit of comic irony in the password choice there, Cisco. Good job. You made us laugh. Thank you.
I just can't believe that they're still belting these out this year. It's just wild. Like, I mean, this has turned into a running gag on this podcast that shouldn't pay off anymore, you know?
No, but Cisco, they help us deliver the gags. So,
they do. Yeah. Thank you, Cisco. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you. Good job.
Well, mate, that is actually it for the week's news. Thanks a lot for joining us, as always, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Thanks very much, Pat. I will talk to you then, and I look forward to Cisco's next password choices.
That was Adam Bailo there. Big thanks to him for that. And yeah, it'll be really interesting to see if like the Tor team wind up baking a few hard-coded Cloudflare public server certs into their clients so they can kind of replace domain-fronted transport with encrypted SNI. Maybe some of the you know, encrypted messaging app makers will be doing that as well. So I'll be paying attention to that. Anyway, moving on, this week's show is brought to you by Rapid7. And this week we're speaking with Rapid7's Jen Andre. Jen joined Rapid7 last year when the company she founded, Command, was acquired by Rapid7. So I figured I'd get Jen on the line and ask her some pretty general questions, really, about security automation and orchestration. So yeah, I thought we could do a bit of a dive on the topic and see what this type of tech is all about. For Jen, the need for better automation became obvious to her when she was working for an MSSP as long ago as the early 2000s. So I'll just pick up the interview there. Here she is.
Yeah, so you can imagine, you know, MSSPs back in the early 2000s, like dealing with some kind of primitive tooling, but same sort of problems that MSSPs or SOCs deal with today, where you get all of these security events from all these different devices. You know, obviously there's going to be some false positives in there. So the job of the analyst is really to triage these using the context they can get from the event itself, or from other tools, if they have access to PCAPs, or threat intel sources to correlate against. And tools like SIMS and other tooling tries to make that easy, but as you know, like it's not perfect, and you just see an analyst with, you know, their console open with the SIM events, plus like 10 or 15 other tabs of other tools that they might use to do their job. And once they've actually confirmed that it's an incident, they might want to figure out, okay, well, like, what's the best way to respond? I need to communicate this to the customer. So they're manually creating tickets. And just doing that over and over and over again, 10 or 15 or hundreds of times per day. And it's very manual, repetitive work, right?
Yeah.
It's not fun work.
So, yeah, I mean, I may have spent a bit of time in front of an IDS console in the early 2000s myself. And I did. I mean, even back then, I noticed that most of what I was doing to follow up various, you know, signatures firing, I mean, it was a pretty repetitive process that even back then I was thinking, well, you could automate this, but it's a little bit too important. There's a little bit too much nuance in it. So you kind of have to do the boring stuff. So what's changed, I guess, is the question. I guess what's changed is a lot of that context. You can now automate, right? Whereas back then you couldn't.
Yeah. And like, honestly, because I was trained as a programmer, I would try to, using the tools I had, automate my job. So manual, like writing little scripts that would fetch data for me. We had a bunch of logs in a database that like I'd had a set of scripts that I'd written to query against just to automate it and make it faster. But a lot of my peer analysts didn't have those skills and that ability. So fast forward to today. It was really actually surprising to me that teams were struggling with the same sort of problems. And yes, like I think the console, the sim consoles have gotten better, but you know, like it's threats are dynamic, right? So the tools that you use to investigate a particular type of threat, like look like you can automate it up to some point, but your automation will get stale if you don't update it. So like you need to check new threat intel sources, use different tools to actually get the context you need. And again, like I think a ton of people today still struggle with automating it.
And well, think about let's just roll back a second and talk about Command. You know, this is obviously the business that you founded, which was acquired by Rapid7 last year for the precise sum, I believe, was a boatload of money. Well done. what was the specific purpose of Command when you founded it, you know, a few years back?
Yeah. So what do you think about like security teams are dealing with a bunch of manual work? And you think about that problem and you're like, okay, well, there's APIs and there's like the natural solution for most teams is like, we should automate these things that we're doing repetitively to make it easier. And maybe we can buy tools that can help us with that and get us like a third of the way there. But maybe like we'll just hire some programmers or whatever, or like have someone on the team that knows some Python and actually build out that automation. And this is actually still very hard for a lot of teams. So some of our customers who recognize that they need to automate things will, you know, in their spare time, try to do that. But because they're not expert programmers and they're dealing with a ton of different tools, and it's not just the tools that they use in their security team, by the way, if they want to instrument and automate a process, they're often dealing with other tools in their environment as well, right? You're dealing with, if you want to get context from Active Directory or other IT tools like your Google apps or Google infrastructure, you have to be able to connect to those APIs as well. So, you know, I think like automation is a natural solution that people go to or think of when they see a process that's boring that's repetitive and tedious and involves a lot of like context gathering or just these discrete tasks across these different tools. But automation is hard for a lot of security teams because number one, it's not their full-time job. So they're often finding time to carve out from their other responsibilities to actually learn enough Python, figure out these APIs to actually do the automation. And they're not trained as programmers, right? So it might take them some time to get up to speed to be able to build a robust enough automation that they can put into their environment.
Okay, so so you found this company because, you know, you can see that there's challenges there in that, you know, you don't want your SOC turning into a development house trying to figure out how to automate its own workflow. So that makes a lot of sense. But how do you then turn that into some sort of generic, you know, automation product? What does that even look like, right? Because it sounds great. You know, and I can see as like a consulting service, people go in there and build it for you. But how do you actually build an automation product that can plug into multiple SOCs?
Yeah. So when you think about it, there's a couple difficulties, right? It's figuring out all the different APIs, and the APIs have gotten better. But if you look at a lot of security products and tools that are used within your infrastructure, they're not amazing. So how can you build a subtraction layer on top of these APIs that's easy to consume and that you can plug together to actually...
Well, and easy to build and then easy to sell as well, right? When you're trying to found a company. So I can definitely see the challenge. I'm wondering how you solved that.
Yeah. So what we did is we created this, what we call our SDK plugin layer that actually abstracts out all these discrete actions you might want to take across all your tools, like what something that might kick off an automation event, which we call a trigger. And we created not only just that, like, okay, we created this concept, but we created this workflow building layer that allows you to connect them together. So if you've ever used a product like If This and That or Zapier, which tries to do that for different spaces, like the consumer space, the consumer IoT space, Zapier does it for like marketing automation. We do that basically, but for security tools and the infrastructure that you might want to automate as part of a security process. And not only that, we make it easy to extend. So we built like this really simple like code generation tool that generates this plugin for you. You just fill in a couple of lines of Python or Go, which we support as well. And that actually allows you to extend the plugin with other functionality that you might need.
So this is very much a tool that is about ingesting information directly from APIs. You know, it's not like a Seam helper that you plug into, you know, Seams or whatever. This is something that, you know, it's its own thing. It ingests the data itself. And then, you know, what's its output, though? I'm curious about that.
Yeah, the output is almost anything. So, like, in the back end, it's all kind of JSON. So each different plugin might take some particular piece of input and might output some piece of input. And the magic's in our workflow builder, because you can actually, we take those inputs and outputs and turn them into variables, and you can use our little drop-down menu to pass them into additional steps. So you're really just creating this data flow process that maps data from one step to another. And at certain points in the workflow, you can emit data for an analyst to review. So we call them artifacts.
It sounds kind of generic, and like it would have applications beyond security, to be honest. Like something like that that actually is executed well and works, you know, you can see it popping up everywhere.
Yeah, so we actually do have some of our customers that have branched beyond, I think, like the typical incident response use cases. So one of our early customers, they're a totally distributed team. So the whole company is distributed, and they're telling us that, you know, when they need to fire someone or let someone go, they actually need to remove access very, very quickly, because that person's not going to come into the office. They're going to be able to confiscate their laptop and their YubiKeys and whatever. They just have to turn everything off once they give them the notice. And they use it to, I think, implement a traditional IT process, which is deprovisioning the user. Yeah. And you could do the corollary like for provisioning the user as well, but doing it across a variety of different tools very, very quickly, so they could mitigate the risk of something going bad when that happens.
Okay. So you build this thing, you know, I think, you know, we were just talking before we recorded, you just raised a Series A, and then, you know, Rapid7 came along with a big, with a giant novelty check and said, we'll take that. Thank you very much. Is the plan for Rapid7 to, you know, continue to sell this product, or is it more technology they wanted to enhance their own products, or like what's their play with your tech?
Yeah, absolutely. So, we've been selling basically and enhancing the version that we came in with, which was an on-premise version, kind of standalone that lives in customers' environments. And what we've done is actually changed up the architecture a bit so it could work with the rest of the Rapid7 Insight Cloud. So there's the core automation piece runs on-premise still, but if you're using a different, like a Rapid7 SIM product, for example.
Yeah, okay, I get it. So they've got their own version for their own stuff, and then meanwhile you're still selling, you know, your original product, right? Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So the question becomes, you know, I mean, you know, that deal went through like a year and a half ago. The company had been around for some time before that. So, you know, you've been in this game for something like, you know, 3 or 4 years on the command side at least. So the question becomes, what are the remaining challenges? Like what are the sticking points when you are trying to do something like this? Where my question is, and it's going to be an awkward one for you to answer, where does tech like this fall down, right?
Yeah, so I think the challenges that we try to make easier, I think obviously when you're trying to instrument a bunch of different tools and APIs that aren't always reliable, having really good error handling and being able to understand like, hey, this API actually broke, it's no longer meeting the contract, being able to rapidly either we can fix it or the customer can fix it themselves.
Making it less brittle because of people's crappy APIs, I think is the TLDR, right?
Yep. And I think like the other thing that we get is like, look, like, and it's not so much like a technology problem, but oftentimes customers are less mature than you think they are. And you think they might come in, they understand like what a great process might be to investigate.
Yeah, but they have absolutely no way to execute it, right? Like I've had those conversations. Yeah. They're funny.
But sometimes they don't even know. They're like, can you guys help us? Like, what's the best practice for these sort of things?
Yeah,
like,
we're planning on landing our rocket on Mars and we need a rover. And it's like, dude, you don't have a rocket.
Yep, exactly. So how can we provide customers with more guidance specific like things that they should be automating, you know?
What it sounds like is this type of tech, and this is what I was trying to draw out in this interview, because yeah, this is a promotional interview for Rapid7, whatever, but I like to use these sort of segments to get a bit of an idea about where a technology is at. And it sounds like if you're a shop that's got its shit together and you're using products that aren't janky and brittle, then this can deliver real value. And, you know, I'm guessing the plan is to try to broaden that out and be able to be a little bit more fault tolerant when it comes to dealing with people's broken APIs and try to get more traction that way. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, relying on partners as well and other folks like beyond just us to just like maintain these things. We have kind of this basic first version of a community, but we already have customers that share. They all kind of live in a single Slack channel. They share the content they've created, whether it's, you know, plugin updates or different workflows they've created.
So we've got to wrap it up shortly, but I just want to get an example of a type of workflow that you're automating that's very, very popular with customers. Like, because we talk about these things in these really high level sort of macro ways. Like, what's like the number one use case? And it can be as simple as you like. What's the number one use case for Command?
Yeah, I think it would either be something, the phishing one, I think, is a traditional example where teams, you know, obviously they buy products like Proofpoint, other things that live on their edge that try to block phishing emails before they actually get to employees. But for every email that gets through, you know, we all know prevention is not perfect. We also want a strategy to deal with the threats that do get through. And they want their employees to forward these emails to their security team so the security team can investigate. And behind that is someone who's sitting at that email box, triaging that, looking for things like suspicious URLs, maybe putting that through a sandbox, something that captures a screenshot, grabbing those URLs, feeding them to threat reputation sources.
So it's just all those crappy little manual steps. You know, and the last person, it's actually from a competing vendor, but the last person I asked to give me their number one automation use case gave me the same one. So I totally believe you that doing all of those things, like looking at, you know, throwing the headers at tool X, you know what I mean? If there's a file attached, doing these three things with it, and then, you know, just being able to tick all of those boxes, that makes a lot of sense. All right, Jen, Andre, thank you very much for joining us to have a bit of a chat about, you know, some of this security automation and orchestration stuff. Thanks a lot for coming along and sort of explaining that tech to us and giving us a bit more context around it. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Jen Andre of Rapid7 there. Big thanks to her for that. If you are interested in putting some of what Jen was talking about there into action, do get in touch with Rapid7. And I've linked through to a couple of relevant Rapid7 pages in this week's show notes. But that's it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next time, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.